Greetings. I'm Austin Egbert, the director of Mind Matters. Welcome to another Mind Matters BingeCast, where multiple interviews are fused into a single program. Today's BingeCast features a frank chat with Dr. Jay Richards about the outrageous and often silly claims made by Yuval Harari about artificial intelligence. Now, here's your host for Mind Matters, Robert J. Marks.
Greetings. Will infotech and biotech erode human agency, subvert human desires, and render free market economics obsolete? At first glance, there looks to be a wide gap between the future of AI and the destruction of democracy. In a cheery little column published in The Atlantic, Yuval Noah Harari posits AI will ultimately destroy democracy and favor digital dictatorships. What is his argument, and does it hold any water? That's the topic today we'll be discussing with our guest, Dr. Jay Richards. Jay Richards has a PhD in philosophy and theology with honors from Princeton Theological Seminary. He holds a professor position at the School of Business and Economics at the Catholic University of America and is the executive editor of The Stream. The Stream, which I am becoming more familiar with, is a resource that champions, and this is on their website, it champions freedom, smaller government, and human dignity. The site authoritatively challenges the worst in mainstream media and does not shy away from the topic of God. Really good stuff. It's available online at stream.org. Not thestream.org, but stream.org. Jay is also a senior fellow at the Walter Bradley Center for Natural and Artificial Intelligence. He has written many interesting books, two of which I have read, The Privileged Planet, co-authored with Guillermo Gonzalez, and his latest book, The Human Advantage, The Future of American Work in an Age of Smart Machines. As you would suppose from the title of the book, Jay has expertise in the topic of AI and its future impact. Jay, I have to confess with you, I didn't read your book. I listened to it. Have you listened to your book yet?
I haven't listened to it, but I did put in the request with the publisher that they release the audiobook simultaneous with the hardcover, because that's honestly what I do. I've gotten to where I initially now, at least with nonfiction books, I listen to them first. And then if I need the references, actually, then I buy it. So sometimes Amazon gets me both for an Audible and for a hard or a paperback. So I do the same thing.
Ditto here. I listen to the book, and if I do need the references, or sometimes you can't see the figures, you have to actually buy the book from them. Jay, Harari forecasts that AI could transform democracy into a tyranny. Who is Yuval Noah Harari? I know you said you've read a couple of his books.
I have. And so, I mean, he's actually a historian of medieval history. He's an Israeli historian. He's actually at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. He got his PhD at Jesus College in Oxford. And for years, he was writing sort of on his discipline. But here in the last 10 years or so, he's been writing on these, I don't know what you want to call this, kind of macro history, these sweeping histories of everything. And so two fairly recent books, one called Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind, and then a really recent one from 2016, it's called Homo Deus, A Brief History of Tomorrow. And so the first book, Sapiens, it proposes to sort of give us a history of all of human history and anchor us back in cosmic history. This Homo Deus, as you might guess, you know, man, the god, is a kind of a speculative history of the future and where he actually imagines things going. This recent piece in The Atlantic, I think, sort of fits into that category. For listeners that haven't ever heard of him, think of him as a hardcore scientistic reductionist who thinks that the kind of materialistic take on science at any particular moment trumps actually any other source of knowledge or anything you might suspect, and who also buys the sort of strong AI program. So he assumes that at some point here in the next 25 years, technology is going to supersede us. And so he buys that whole program. And so that's, you know, this just follows in line with where he's been going. And this actually very depressing piece in The Atlantic fits perfectly with certainly the intellectual trajectory he's had for the last several years.
So what in your mind is a summary of his objectives in the piece? As I mentioned in the introduction, I called it a cheery little article, and I hope the idea that cheery was what's meant to be, what's the word?
Sarcastic.
Sarcastic, exactly. So I hope the sarcasm came across. No, it was very depressing. What was your impression of it in general? What was he trying to do?
In general, essentially, he is glomming on to this claim that we're reaching a point in which artificial intelligence and robotics are going to make a lot of the human race obsolete. And he focuses in particular on manual labor, but also on cognitive work. And he thinks, as many of the other prognosticators do, that this is going to make a lot of people irrelevant. It's going to make a lot of people's activities have absolutely no economic value. But the twist he makes on this is that he also thinks that this is likely to lead to a tyranny, a sort of digital dictatorship of a few elites who control the masses. And I should say, this is quite the change from the book that he wrote, Sapiens, before the 2016 election, in which he predicted the end of nationalism and the end of the nation state. And then lo and behold, Donald Trump gets elected, Brexit happens, and now he thinks liberal democracy is all kaput, and in fact we're heading for some kind of dictatorship. And so, as I said, I mean, this piece is in the Atlantic, but Harari is in many ways a kind of Geiger counter of elite conventional wisdom, and he certainly doesn't disappoint in this piece.
Well, the collapse of democracy into tyranny, he makes some points, and let me play his side. Maybe he has some good points. He talks, for example, about Nazi Germany as an example, and how they were having all of this economic and nationalism upheaval, and it was a democracy, and that's how Hitler got in and became a tyrant.
No, that's right. And this is the difficulty with his piece, is that he uses the word democracy over and over, but I'm never quite sure what he's talking about. Sometimes when he uses it, I think what he means is representative government. Other times, it seems like he's talking about limited government. Sometimes I think he's talking about free markets. Other times he's talking about, I think, just the idea that people have individual rights and that every individual ought to be respected. Well, that's a kind of bundle of ideas. I would say that's a cluster of really good ideas that were developed in Western civilization. But it's not exactly clear that that's what he's talking about. Yes, the American founders were quite opposed to democracy, if by that word you meant popular democracy, because that would just end up being a sort of dictatorship of the majority. And so, unfortunately, by never defining these terms in any way, I'm never quite sure what his argument is. When I first looked at the title of the piece, I thought he was going to talk about the danger of the surveillance state and the possibility that the government, can obviously monitor what we're doing much more profoundly and in greater detail than it could at any time in the past. But that's actually not what he talks about. Insofar as he has a detailed point, he talks about the ownership of data, which I do think is a problem. We have to think about, okay, what kind of barriers do we put up in order to protect our privacy? What are we going to do about the ownership of personal data that technology companies can get a hold of? But all of those perfectly legitimate points, I think, kind of get lost in this sort of grandiose materialistic vision that is really the sort of backdrop for his argument.
Let me read you some of the quotes that come from his article and get your reaction to them. I certainly had strong reactions to them. One of them is, democracy success in the 20th century depended on unique technological conditions that may prove ephemeral.
I have no idea what he could be talking about here. This is the oddest thing. First of all, of course, everyone that takes a civics course knows that America is a republic, not a democracy. But let's grant him that point, right? But none of these depended upon the 20th century technologies, obviously. I mean, the American founding happened two and a half centuries earlier. So I can't imagine what he can possibly be talking about. And then, if you think about sort of the growth of economic freedom, for instance, well, there's been a huge amount of growth in economic freedom since 1990. In fact, the number of people living in absolute poverty has been cut in half globally since 1990. But none of it was dependent upon 20th century technology. It was based upon institutions, rule of law, limited government, checks and balances, economic freedom. These things, none of these are technological things. They're cultural and institutional things. And so this is why I honestly think he's using the word democracy as a kind of bundle term to refer to a heck of a lot of different things. And this is the perfect example of this, the idea that democracy depends on unique technological conditions of the 20th century. It's just a very weird claim by itself.
It does seem to be weird. As I mentioned, I think he makes a lot of suppositions and then jumps a big chasm to the conclusions. Mm-hmm. And I think this is one of the cases. Technology, definitely. The only thing that I could come up with, and let me get your reaction on this, is technically superior in a military sense. Certain democracy would not have survived had there not been the technological superiority of the Allies in World War II over the Nazis and the Japanese, with the atomic bomb Enigma, the Norton bomb sight, Alan Turing cracking Enigma, and things of that sort. So do you think that that could have been a connection?
Well, I honestly think that what you're giving a better version of his argument than he provides, because he doesn't say anything about that. He seems to think that, in fact, this sort of he seems to actually think that somehow economic freedom itself, limited government, sort of wide play for economic exchange, that somehow this depends on technology. Whereas if he was saying, well, if it hadn't been for the atomic bomb and the American military and the Allies, democracy might have lost, he could have made that argument, but of course he doesn't. And as we know from history, I mean, if things had turned out slightly differently and Nazis had held on for a couple more years, they might actually have gotten a nuclear bomb before we did. So, it's very hard even to reconstruct this particular point, even charitably in a version that makes sense, except that I just think we have to say he's using democracy to refer to, it's kind of all the things he likes and thinks are generally a good thing that he's worried we're going to lose.
Okay. Yeah, if you watched The Man in the High Castle, it's a program which supposes that the Nazis had developed the bomb first and had used it to win World War II. And so there are these alternative history sort of ways of thinking about things.
Yes, absolutely. And it's, this is, again, I think that because Harari is so sort of impressive as a public intellectual, he's had these international bestsellers, that sometimes I think when you read him, you're tempted to think, okay, he must have some subtle thing happening here. But I honestly think if you understand him as a widely read, but actually kind of intellectually shallow materialist and reductionist, you actually, that gives you the kind of hermeneutical key you need to follow his argument.
Yeah, I had difficulty. Okay, let me give you another quote.
Yeah.
Quote, ordinary people may not understand artificial intelligence and biotechnology in any detail, but they can sense the future is passing them by. Then he goes on to say, most people in Birmingham, Istanbul, St. Petersburg, and Mumbai are only dimly aware, if they are aware at all, of the rise of AI and its potential impact on their lives.
This, again, is a funny sort of thing in which clearly, an intellectual elite channels what he thinks people in Birmingham are thinking. But I said, I don't know if he's talking about Birmingham, England, or Birmingham, Alabama here, but probably both. But the reality is, at least, if you look at the economic indicators in the United States, that doesn't seem to be the general impression that people have. There is, I've looked at these polls, and a lot of people do think artificial intelligence and robotics are going to replace a lot of people's jobs. But most people also think they're going to replace other people's jobs and not their own, strangely enough. Now, I do think the disruption of information technology is something that we really need to grapple with, especially the rapidity of disruption in this particular era. But I think what he's doing is he's channeling the elite angst of people who believe in the strong AI program and expect machines to literally replace us. But I honestly think the ordinary person, unless they're watching sci-fi, this isn't the main thing that they're actually worried about. Whether they should or not, it's a good question. But he sort of imagines that, well, these people don't really understand, but in fact, their lives and their livelihood are going to be overturned. So it's just, it's the sort of channeling of an intellectual elite, someone like Karl Marx, who claims to speak for the textile factory workers, but never bothers to go to the textile factory and actually interview anyone.
Yeah, exactly. I was really troubled by his use of ordinary people. That certainly smacks immediately of elitism.
Definitely.
I often come to work early and go to a McDonald's here. And I sit down with some of the people that work, for example, ordinary people, if you will, that work in the mess halls, that and actually homeless people. And you talk to them, and I think some of them do live in silos, does, but I tell you, a lot of them know what's going on. I don't think the ordinary person should be underestimated in their knowledge of what is going on.
Absolutely. You don't, dangerous. And it's not like you need to know how the internet works, right? Or how your computer works to be plugged in. I mean, the truth of the matter is people that are virtually everyone, you know, in the United States is connected to social media and using email and these sorts of things. And so it's not like technical knowledge is required in order to be able to access these things.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I tell you what, they all have cell phones.
So absolutely. And speaking of homeless people, when I lived in Seattle, we always had a lunch for the homeless on Sundays. And my youngest daughter would say, well, Daddy, why do the homeless people all have iPhones? And I never actually had a good answer for that. But that shows you how ubiquitous it is.
It is. And I think it shows that certainly they know at least a little bit of what is happening in AI, number one. And number two, that is a little portal to all of the knowledge in the world.
Absolutely.
And if they're curious at all, they certainly can find out some different things. That's Here's right. a related quote mm-hmm. from Harari. It's section two, a new useless class. Hmm. He says, most of the new jobs will presumably demand high levels of expertise and ingenuity, and therefore may not provide an answer to the problem of unemployed, unskilled laborers, or workers employable only at extremely low wages.
Well, this is the popular impression, but as you know, Bob, about Moravec's paradox, we can make machines that can beat the reigning champions at Jeopardy or beat the reigning champion at chess. We can't build a robot that can do what any competent three-year-old can do with his hands. And so, you know, I often tell people, look, there are going to be a lot of sort of easily, easily reducible jobs that can be reduced to rules, or highly repetitive jobs, say in factories or in the office. Yeah, those are likely to get replaced. They're likely to get mechanized in some way. The landscaper and the carpenter and the housekeeper, actually, those are much tougher nuts to crack. I also think that there's a whole new class of jobs that are just now coming to the fore that I call bespoke labor, in which people suddenly, when things like food and various goods become cheaper and cheaper and cheaper, people suddenly start preferring highly specialized things. So even though people can buy sort of mass-produced, factory-farmed produce at their local grocery store, they're perfectly happy to spend five times more and go to the farmer's market and to get locally sourced and pasture-raised chicken and eggs and cows and pork. And I think that what's actually happening is that we're going to have a double economy in which lots of things are produced very cheaply in a mechanized way, and yet people are going to prefer these kind of interesting bespoke services and labor, just as people can, you can buy a cheap cup of coffee at any diner, but people still spend $4 getting a fancy coffee at Starbucks.
I never understood that.
No, but it's economists know that people choose things. We value things for our own personal reasons. And so you can't really reduce what people choose to kind of simple economic calculation. Because really when people are buying coffee at Starbucks, they're not just buying coffee. They're buying a coffee-related experience. They're buying the atmosphere. They're buying the kind of the signaling of what it means to meet there. It's a bunch of other things. And I think it's the same thing with a lot of these interesting agricultural choices that people make. They just want something that was served to them and made by a person that they have a relationship with. And so, you know, whether that makes sense or not, I think that's what people tend to choose. And I think we'll actually see more of that in the future.
Absolutely. I want to return to something that you mentioned previously, which is Moravec's paradox. Hmm. And I found that fascinating. I just learned about Moravec's paradox, I don't know, 6 months ago or something. Mm-hmm. Could you give an explanation of what that is? You did a little bit, but I think this was actually discovered in the early days of AI research, yes?
Yes, exactly. It's named after a famous robotics professor named Hans Moravec, and it's basically the idea that it's easier to reduce knowledge that is knowledge about something, so data, you know, or something that can be reduced to an algorithm or a system of rules. We're really good at using machines to do those kinds of things. So maybe, you know, sorting things into a database according to particular properties. On the other hand, things that involve complex movement in three-dimensional space. So the stuff that we do, the know-how, that you learn how to do something with your hands, to sculpt or to play golf, that's a much tougher nut to crack because there's all these complex feedbacks. You know, I've got some green tea here with me and I pick up the glass And I know about what the hardness of the glass and its weight, in part because I'm getting this complex feedback between my eyes and the tips of my fingers and my arm. The computational resources to actually pull that off are really, really vast. And so we're good at building robots, for instance, that do one or a few tasks over and over, and they can do it much faster than a human could ever do. But this kind of general body movement, it's an entirely different problem. And so this is why if you go to an Amazon fulfillment center, the thing is just an amazing feat of automation with forklifts that pick up pallets of goods without anyone monitoring or driving them. And yet right at the end of the process, you have human beings taking the products and putting them in boxes, because wow. At the moment, it's only humans that have the ability to say, oh, that's a roll of toilet paper. That's a fragile champagne glass. Oh, that's an iPod. We can do that. And so I'm not saying that we'll never develop robots that can do those kinds of things. But the idea that jobs involving that are going to be the first to go, I think it's deeply misguided. People that actually know something about robotics know that, no, that's going to be much more difficult. The kind of labor jobs that I would expect to disappear would be the ones in which people are doing really, really simple things in an assembly line. The irony there is those types of jobs are only a century or so old. The assembly line was invented by Henry Ford, and socialists at the time complained. They said, well, that is men doing the work of machines. They're just doing this kind of mindless, repetitive work. And to which I say, well, I think they probably had a point. And there was a moment in economic history in which we needed people to do that. I do think those types of jobs will become obsolete. It doesn't follow, as any smart economist will tell you, that there won't be any other jobs for people to do, or that all the jobs will require technical knowledge. Nothing in economic history would tell us that. Machines replace current ways of doing things, and then we discover new things that we can do given the new economic situation.
The free enterprise system in capitalism is very robust in correcting.
It is. And that's what's funny about Harari's article, because he talks about both democracy and the free market. And in fact, he argues that, well, one reason that markets worked in the 20th century is that markets are better at sorting goods and services. And so a dictator, for instance, or a committee in the Soviet Union, they couldn't figure out how to price things. So they would just come up with fake prices and fake production quotas. And so it never did work. It didn't work as well as a market in which people are buying and selling and estimating they want based in part on price signals. But then he argues in this piece that, of course, now we're going to have these amazing computers that can do all these really fast calculations. And so then we could have an economic dictator that can actually do all these things. But this is only somebody that's never actually read any economics would make this argument, because the point about the reason the market works better than a command economy, it's not a calculation problem. The argument is that, look, what a market is millions of people making subjective evaluations about how much they value something at a particular moment. And how much I value a glass of water at one moment is going to differ from how much I value it, say, right after I've had a glass of water. And so the argument against central planning is that no matter how quick you could calculate it, nobody has access to all the economic judgments that people make at any particular moment. And so the only way to distribute goods and services that takes account of that is a market with the rule of law and a price system. And then the prices signal all of that information. And so Harari here, he's completely out of his depth when he starts talking about economics. And honestly, I thought I think he's only ever kind of gotten these arguments from a distance. And so he's just sort of wandered into an area that, unfortunately, he's a smart guy. He could learn this very quickly, but he clearly hasn't.
Yeah, that was my takeaway also, that I'm the last to invoke the idea of a genetic fallacy in any sort of discussion, but a person needs to get outside of their own silo and acquire the domain expertise they need if they're going to talk about a specific topic. Jay, we're out of time. Would you continue this in a follow-up episode?
Absolutely. Happy to do it.
Okay, great. So that concludes things today. There will be a follow-up episode on Mind Matters with Dr. Jay Richards. And until then, be of good cheer. Greetings. We've been talking with Dr. Jay Richards about a recent article by Yuval Noah Harari that posits that AI will ultimately destroy democracy and favor digital dictatorships. One of the things that I've been doing with Dr. Richards is going through some of the quotes from the paper, and we're kind of commenting on them. One of them, which is near and dear to my heart, is the idea of creativity and the ability of computers and AI to actually create. Jay, let me read you a quote and get your reaction to this. The world of chess serves an example of where things might be heading. One of the ways to catch cheaters in a chess tournament today is to monitor the level of originality that player exhibits. What do you think?
Well, I guess he's treating originality as if that's a kind of unique property of creativity. But I mean, I suppose that's one of them. But so once somebody creates something, it's not as if that is the sort of only way to do that. There's also expertise. There's also learning a skill. And so if somebody's really good at, you know, shooting a rim shot in basketball, it's a skill. And we would say, look, there's human ingenuity in that. And I think that he's sort of imagining that chess players, for instance, are going to become obsolete. But I mean, I would say, let's ask somebody like Garry Kasparov what he says. Garry Kasparov tells us that it's exactly the opposite, that, yeah, chess software, it's not creative in this. I mean, it churns through lots of different games and, you know, you can load them up with millions of previous games. Nevertheless, there are these interesting hybrids, these centaurs between human beings using programs, and they're doing things that neither could do on their own. And so I just think, yeah, he's essentially confusing. In this case, I think he's confusing originality with expertise.
I actually agree. I think if a computer makes a really interesting new move, it is something which he is, I'm referring to the computer as a male, the computer has actually learned that from a training process. And the idea that you catch chess cheaters by looking at the originality of their plays, and that in some way is creativity, is frankly kind of absurd. The other thing that I would argue with is the definition of creativity. Chess software is not creative. If a chess program learned to play Go or invented another board game, then I would say, yeah, boy, it's being creative if it did so without being programmed to do that. So that is creativity, and that would be creative. So
That's right. And this is the sort of difficulty, especially when you get into machine learning. And he gives some examples of this in which solutions are found that the programmer himself didn't put into it, except that, of course, we know, look, these are statistical algorithms that are culling information, and they're designed to do that. But if you think of creativity as something that's a purposive activity of an intelligent agent that chooses from among a range of possibilities for something new, you have to sort of beg the question and assume that the machine is conscious in order to call that creative, which I actually do think, if you read his book, especially Sapiens, he very often speaks of inanimate objects as if they're conscious. For instance, he says, rather than us domesticating wheat, it's really better to think about what wheat wanted and the ways in which it domesticated us. And he's only half joking when he speaks that way.
Really?
Yes.
Half joking, not totally.
Only half joking when he speaks that way. And if you think about it, I mean, if you're a really hardcore materialist, then we ourselves are not agents. We are way stations. And this, there were moments in this impersonal process of cosmic evolution, which is actually, and turns out that's what he thinks in Homo Deus, that we're passing on to a sort of technological stage of evolution in which human beings will be obsolete. He thinks Homo sapiens will be gone in 200 years. And so this kind of thinking actually follows, I think, from his deeply committed materialism.
I actually read a quote of his on Wikipedia where he basically says that. I didn't follow up the source, but he said basically, I forget the time period, there will no longer be people in the universe. This is a hard AI sort of stance, and it seems that he's firmly entrenched in that idea.
Yeah, exactly. And what's funny is, that, I mean, his training is as an historian, but in some ways, I often argue that these debates, when it comes to AI, they might look like they're about technology, when in fact, very often they are debates about metaphysics and philosophy. You know, what's the nature of human beings? What's the nature of machines? And because he's already a thoroughgoing materialist, he doesn't have any kind of in principle reason not to say, well, if we're just machines determined by the laws of physics, surely machines we design can ultimately exceed and so replace us.
One of my favorite sayings by Niels Bohr, the pioneer in quantum mechanics is the forecasting is very dangerous, especially if it's about the future.
And, that's right.
And we see in here so many places where maybe, could be, these hedge sort of terms in the forecasting, which really, I think, detract from any substantive scholarly presentation. Without some domain expertise behind it, forecasting in a silo isn't going to get you anywhere.
It's not. And I, you know, reading this piece and then reading Homo Deus and then recently reading George Gilder's new book, Life After Google. Well, Gilder has had an amazing track record of predicting technological innovations 10 and 20 years in the future. But he doesn't go in for these kind of fanciful materialist ideas. And he always talks about the nature of human creativity is it's about surprise. And so you might be able to talk about trends, but we don't actually know what people are going to invent to create tomorrow. We don't know all the kinds of jobs people are going to do because they don't exist yet. And so in some ways, it comes down to, well, do you have faith in the capacity of human beings to actually create value and to continue to create value? Or do you buy this kind of, frankly, very depressing materialistic story, in which case, you know, you're looking for disaster around every corner.
Exactly. Here's another quote, your reaction. Now, this is said in context in a very negative, sad way. He says, people will need to retrain and reinvent themselves, not just once, but many times.
This is a weird complaint because this, if you anyone that's read Aristotle knows that, that's the whole life of virtue. I mean, what we're supposed to do is read John Paul II. He has an encyclical from 1987 in which he says, through our work, we create things that were not there before as creatures made in the image of God, and we, in a sense, become even more human than we were in the beginning. Of course, you are human by your nature. But it's the nature of human beings to be able to, you can choose the good or you can choose the bad. And if you habitually choose the good over and over, you, in a sense, kind of rework what you are and who you are, and you become more than you were at the beginning. I think that's good news. It's we're not just a hamster running on a wheel and not getting anywhere. Now, he's exactly right that people that are, say, graduating from college today are going to have to pivot a lot more than people had to 50 years ago. The age of going to college for 4 years and then assuming that you'll have exactly the same job for the next 4 years or the next 40 years, I think that's unlikely just because of the pace of technological change. But whereas he sees this as a disaster, I see this as an opportunity for us to grow more in our capacity as humans.
I agree with you so much. Autobiographically, as a professor, I tell other professors, if you're a good professor in engineering, which is my area, you need to actually re-earn your PhD every 5 to 7 years. And doing that is such an invigorating process. It keeps you always on the treadmill and keeps your life very, very exciting.
So it does.
I don't see that this is a problem at all. I don't know how it translates to all other vocations, but certainly in mine, it's something that we want to do, continual reinvention.
Yeah, and you know, there's a funny little book by Scott Adams, the Dilbert cartoon guy, who's kind of, again, himself, he's reinvented himself as a social commentator, but he has a book on failure, and I can't remember the title, but it's essentially how to fail at almost everything and still win big. And he talks about something called talent stacks. And so talent stacks is where you develop, you become pretty good at several different, really different things that kind of overlap. And he used himself as an example. He's not by any means the best cartoonist in terms of his actual expertise. He's not a great business mind. Nevertheless, he figured out how to draw. He did get an MBA second at the bottom of his class at Berkeley. He spent years working in office situations. And then he combined those two things into a winning comic strip. And so that's how I think people ought to think. Think about developing several different kinds of skills. You don't have to be the very best at that thing, but you might be the unique person in the universe at stacking those different talents in some kind of creative and new way.
Yes, I actually think it's a very exciting thing to do. I think, though, coming from a blue-collar family, which I do, that's a little bit scary maybe for somebody that makes their work in a union and works for, yes, or works for an individual company. It's very scary to not work there anymore and to actually make a transition.
It is. And I think that's the real, the cost of the information economy that we need to spend a lot of time on, because it's one thing to say, well, you know, there are going to be amazing new jobs come online next year. But if you've lost your job today and need to pay the rent next week, that's for cold comfort. And so I do think that disruption itself is a cost. I just think that it's also an opportunity. And so what we want to do is figure out how do we mitigate the downsides and maximize the upsides?
Exactly. Roman numeral 3 of Harari's paper is titled The Rise of Digital Dictatorships. This, again, is forecasting, which if it's in the future is very dangerous. As many people lose their economic value, they might also come to lose their political power. The same technologies that might make billions of people economically irrelevant might also make them easier to monitor and control.
Well, this is based on this assumption that everybody is going to become economically valueless. But, you know, Marx made the same argument in the Communist Manifesto in 1848. He said, as technology becomes more and more, makes people more and more productive, this is what he predicted, that workers in factories would get paid less and less because the machines would do more and more of the work. And so the workers the capitalists, people that own the factories, could pay the workers less and less. Well, what actually happened in 1848 is the wages of workers was going up rather than down. And every economist understands why. A person with a tractor has much more valuable labor than a person with a shovel. And if you're competing for labor and everybody has tractors, that means the people driving them, their labor is going to be more valuable. I just don't buy this idea that because high technology does some things that people are doing now, suddenly people are obsolete. They will simply do different things and interact and be augmented by technology in different ways. But unless you actually think that, first of all, we're machines, and so therefore everything we are can literally be replaced by machines, I don't think that we're in any different situation than human beings were in say 1776, when most people were literally using labor to do farming. And now less than 1.5% of the population in the country lives and works on farms. That rest of the 95% that used to farm is not all out of work. They're doing things that didn't exist in 1776.
Okay, here's another quote. We are unlikely to face a rebellion of sentient machines in the coming decades, but we might have to deal with hordes of bots that know how to press our emotional buttons better than our mother does.
Well, it's weird because at the beginning of the sentence, he said we don't need to worry about sentient machines. And then in the second part of the sentence, he speaks of them as if they're sentient, right? As that they know how to do things. They're manipulating our emotions. This is a very sort of strange thing because, I mean, which is it? And the truth of the matter is he actually does think sentient beings, or beings at least as sentient as we are in his view, are sort of around the corner. But what he's essentially talking about is algorithms that are very good at anticipating the kinds of things that we want. I'm fine with that, honestly. I like the fact that Amazon can anticipate the books that I like based upon my previous purchases, because the alternative is that it's just a sea of millions of books and I don't sort of know anything. And so I think that's what he's talking about. Insofar as he's worried about people manipulating us through highly sophisticated advertising and marketing, great, let's talk about that. But that's ultimately what we're talking about. We're talking about more sophisticated ways of doing marketing.
And I thought, heck, that's what psychologists have been doing for years with advertising. They want to sell us something. And as far as the Amazon targeting the sort of things that you want, that only works if you don't share your Amazon Prime with your daughter. And so I get all of these advertisements of how I should buy new baby bottles
and teenage daughters. And so for me, it's leather boots. For some reason, those are the biggies.
Oh gosh! Hey, I tell you what, I have a challenge. I think we could either go on with a longer podcast, or we can continue this in a third episode. We're up against 15 minutes, and I'd prefer to do the latter, if you wouldn't mind.
Okay, no problem.
Okay, so we'll end this podcast with Dr. Richards, and we'll continue it in a third installment the next time on Mind Matters. Until then, be of good cheer. Greetings. Will InfoTech and Biotech erode human agency, subvert human desires, and render free market economics obsolete? We're continuing in the third installment of a conversation with Dr. J. Richards. What I've been doing is reading some of the quotes from Harari's paper, his article, and kind of discussing them with Dr. Richards. So let's go on with the next quote. Okay, quote, in the late 20th century, democracies usually outperformed dictatorships because they were better in processing information. We tend to think about the conflict between democracy and dictatorship as a conflict between two different ethical systems, but it is actually a conflict between two different data processing systems.
No, it's not. Yeah, it's a very sort of odd argument, I think. I mean, the truth of the matter is, I do think that the more technologically advanced a society is, the more capable a dictatorship can become. So certainly the kind of surveillance state that you could have now can be much more intrusive than what was possible, say, in the 17th century, in which the king, no matter how dictatorial he is, only has so much access and so much reach. But that's actually not what Harari is talking about. I mean, he seems to think that somehow if we're going to have such sophisticated AIs, that these AIs can actually, I don't know, plan and control an economy. But no matter how fast a computer is calculating things, it's not going to have direct access to people's economic judgments and economic values at any particular moment. And so the same basic economic problem that limited socialist planning in the 20th century, none of that's going to change in the 21st century. And I don't care how fast the computers are at calculating, they're still not going to do that. So if somebody thinks, oh, now in this new technocracy, we can sort of install some elites with really sophisticated computers, and they can plan economies, they can put prices on everything, they can determine what production quotas are, well, they might try that, and they will discover just what Vladimir Lenin discovered in the early 20th century, which is that it completely destroys an economy very quickly. And so I don't think there's anything about high technology that's going to change the basic rules of economics and the role of signaling and prices or supply and demand. All those things are still here.
Again, I'm trying to jump the chasm between his comments and the consequences that he claims. Could it be by better at processing information, he means things such as gathering intelligence? Hmm. I think, for example, of the invention of the airplane at the end of World War I. There could be no longer movements behind the lines, secret movements and maneuvers by the enemy in order to put themselves in a position to attack you. The airplane totally did away with that. I'm thinking of radar. All of a sudden, we had radar and technology, and that allowed us to be superior to the Nazis.
That's right.
And you know, a story I heard, this is very interesting. The Nazis were under the impression that something magical was happening because their airplanes were being shot down in the fog and cloudy days. And they wonder what the heck was happening. So the Allies release a piece of propaganda that says the Allied pilots were actually eating carrots. And that's where the idea that carrots were good for your eyes came from.
Interesting. Yeah, that it's funny. And but I think honestly, if we take that sort of line, it's that the truth is exactly the opposite. I mean, if you look at where technological innovation actually takes place, it mostly takes place in free societies in which different groups of people and different firms can try different things. I mean, you look at, China, everyone talks about China as an economic powerhouse, and it is, but in part, that's because it was coming from basically a very primitive agrarian economy, and it's moved into the industrial economy. But look at where most of the great inventions still happen. They still tend to happen in countries with limited government, with patent systems and things like that. And so I don't think there's any reason to think that somehow technology is going to favor dictatorship in any obvious sense.
Yeah, this seemed to be, I have no idea what he means by this. This is, I think in the first broadcast, I read a sentence and you said, I have no idea what he's talking about. I kind of have no idea what he's talking about. I try to give him the benefit of the doubt and make this jump maybe to radar and intelligence and stuff of that sort, but I don't know. It's kind of crazy.
I think that what you're doing is you're providing some things that make his argument better, but I don't actually think that's what he's saying. I think he's saying something quite different. And I do think really to get this essay that Harari has in The Atlantic, it helps to have some background exposure to his previous book. So you sort of see where he's coming from on this.
I see. I also noticed nowhere he doesn't say why the data process or information processing allowed democracies to outperform dictatorships.
No, he doesn't. And so, because the best argument I can think of for that would be that, well, we got a jump on technology. And so we were able to win, in World War II and things like that. But he doesn't say anything like that.
Okay. Roman numeral 4 in Harari's paper is the transfer of authority to machines. Now, I read this, and you know who I immediately thought of? HAL 9000 in 2001, A Space Odyssey. Okay, here's the quote. "But once we begin to count on AI to decide what to study, where to work, and whom to date or even marry, human life will cease to be a drama of decision-making, and our conception of life will need to change. Democratic elections and free markets might cease to make sense. So might most religions and works of art."
This is one of the more obscure statements, I think, in the piece, but I do think that it starts to make sense if you, as he does, imagine that AI actually are going to become sort of super intelligent, conscious agents. If we're just talking about the artificial intelligence we experience, I mean, let's use eHarmony, for instance, eHarmony.com. People are using a more and more sophisticated kind of search mechanism to meet mates. My friend that wrote The Privileged Planet with me, Guillermo Gonzalez, met his wife through eHarmony. And so in a sense, people are using a type of AI to help them make decisions about even who to marry. But again, this is an aid in helping them to make decisions. The AI is not making the decision for them. And if you think about it, I mean, how is this not better than some of the, you know, a lot of people used to meet who they married in bars? I would say actually using something like eHarmony, that's a vast improvement, that we're not losing our agency to that. We're actually finding a way to actually sift through all the complex data, because I think if anything, we still have limited time and limited attention span and limited, you know, capacity for attention. And so I think we're going to need these tools as the proliferation of information continues to accumulate. I think, honestly, this argument only makes sense if you assume that AIs aren't glorified Googles, which is what I think that they're going to be, but rather that they're going to be these sentient, conscious superintelligences that we can actually hand everything over to, even elections and markets.
One of the things I don't get is the assumption that we would actually surrender our decisions to a computer. I'm not going to surrender my decision to a computer of where my kids are to study or where I'm to work or who I'm to date or who I'm to marry. I'm not going to surrender it to that. But there's this assumption, which I think is actually ludicrous.
It is. And I find it funny, honestly. I mean, I live right here in the middle of Washington, D.C. In fact, I'm 3 miles north of the the Capitol. Trust me, as long as there are ambitious people, they're not going to be surrendering any of their decisions to machines.
That's a good point. The politicians are the obvious anti-example, yeah. Right? One of the troubling things here is that all this proliferation of AI, it might make religions obsolete. I know you're a Christian. I'm a Christian.
Yes.
As a person of faith, I don't understand this statement at all. Why would this proliferation of AI make people have religion and consider it obsolete?
I think, again, this is Harari's own thinking. So Harari was raised by secularists. He himself is a committed secularist. If you look at what he says about religion, he thinks religion is essentially about relieving anxiety. And so if we have drugs and machines that relieve, you know, kind of chemical anxiety problems, he thinks religion will be obsolete. But again, he's not really getting this. Look, if you're a Christian, you think it's true. You think it explains reality. And so that's not going to change because you have some kind of fancy computer. But again, he has such a reductionist understanding of religion that he just assumes, well, I mean, it's just a sort of opiate for the masses. And once we've got a better high-tech opiate from biotechnology, nobody's going to need it. I think that's the only thing I can imagine that he has in mind. What I would actually see happening is that the human skills actually are going to become more valuable. So, you know, if you're, say, a physician and you don't have to deal with all the complicated issues having to do with diagnosis because you have a sophisticated Watson program that can determine the diagnosis, then your valuable skill is going to be your bedside manner in bringing the news to people that they have cancer and things like that. And so I would expect ministry and evangelism and the kinds of things that involve human interaction. I think if anything, there's going to be a premium on those kinds of skills. I don't think there are any chance of them becoming obsolete.
My reaction to his statement was shallowness. Again, he's making an assumption, looking at religion from 5,000 miles away and really not getting into the depths and the understanding of what, for example, Christianity is all about.
That's exactly right.
Yes. He goes on, he says, he poses all of these problems. Harari poses all these problems. And then he says, so what shall we do? He said, for starters, we need to place a much higher priority on understanding how the human mind works.
That sounds great to me. Yes, absolutely. What's funny, though, is that if you read his books, he seems to already think he knows how the human mind works. And basically, it's exactly the same as the computers. And so I'm all for that. The question is going to be, that's going to require an understanding or at least a kind of philosophical stance that is appropriate to the thing being studied. If you decided ahead of time that human beings and the human mind are just computers made of meat, we're just machines made of meat, there's nothing you can discover. What you want to do is say, okay, let's position ourselves intellectually to find out what human beings are actually like. And if he would do that, I'd love to join in and doing it. What we don't want is a kind of pre-existing materialism that decides the question ahead of time. Because I think if people just engage in a little introspection about your own experience of yourself, you can realize that you're not actually a machine. I think Harari, in fact, knows that despite himself. But nevertheless, he's adopted this view of human beings that would reduce us to machines.
My reaction in looking at this was a recollection of propositional logic where the false implies true statement is altogether true. So I agree with the consequent. Let's study the human mind. But the other side of the implication, to solve the problem of AI, we need to look at the mind. I don't think that that's the top way to actually address the challenges that he addresses and that I believe are coming in AI. Yes. So
I think that's right. I think that's exactly right. I mean, we're making machines that are doing amazing things, but don't mistake them for what we're doing and what's happening inside our minds. And the truth of the matter is we have a much better sense of our capacities and the fact that we are agents who experience freedom and choice than we have a sense of how exactly it works. That may forever be one of the deepest mysteries.
Absolutely. Okay, next quote. Quote, if we want to prevent the concentration of all wealth and power in the hands of a small elite, we must regulate the ownership of data. Then he goes on later and says, nationalism of data by governments could offer one solution. What do you think?
Well, I mean, so concentration of wealth and power is a bad thing. So therefore, let's concentrate it more as a solution.
Boy, bingo, but, yeah.
You know, I mean, this happens a lot. You often see this among economic progressives is that, well, you've got a few rich guys that are holding all the power. Therefore, let's tax it all away and give it to the people that own the guns and the tanks, right? I mean, the argument's very strange. I think Harari himself sort of realizes, okay, well, that's probably maybe not a great idea if we look at what happened with governments in the 20th century. Nevertheless, he says it's one sort of possibility, and he does then go on to talk about ownership of data and does it, you know, my impression is he does have something like, well, what we want is a collective ownership of data rather than corporate ownership of data. And I suspect that by collective, he ends up meaning, well, the government owns it on behalf of us. And so if anything, if you're worried about the over-concentration of power and wealth, you don't want to increase that power in the hands of the state. That should be plain to everyone.
What do you think the relationship between George Gilder's new book on After Google has with this claim?
Well, what's funny is if you read Gilder's book, he actually thinks that this economy that is developed by, it's really Facebook and Google are the paradigm examples of a kind of a free economy in which we get goods or services really, and it seems like it's for free. So the search that you do on Google, you're not getting charged for it. You don't get charged to set up a Facebook account. And so that part of it is free, but any economist will tell you there's no such thing as a free lunch. So how exactly do they succeed? Well, they succeed actually by getting information, by getting data on your choices. So Google gets information on your searches, and then they use that to drive this revenue model. And Gilder actually thinks this is a highly unstable model because it's not secure. And in fact, there's constantly security problems. And so he actually thinks that this kind of this free economy is quickly going to get displaced or at least disrupted by the emergence of blockchain technology that's actually going to allow all sorts of peer-to-peer interactions that will make this particular way of operating obsolete. And so Gilder's vision, anyone that's read Life After Google that then goes and reads Harari's stuff, I think they will be mostly inoculated to this stuff. And then Gilder, of course, is not at all enamored by these fanciful claims about strong artificial intelligence. I mean, George Gilder, on the one hand, I think Wikipedia accuses him of being a techno-utopian, but in fact, he knows perfectly well that we're not going to gain immortality or our salvation for technology. We may improve the human condition, and it may allow us to do lots of things and create value that we couldn't create before. But it's not ultimately going to save us nor displace us unless we let it do so, unless we let it replace us or displace us.
Excellent. And thank you for correcting me. I think I said the name of the book was Beyond Google, but you mentioned that the name of George Gilder's new book is Life After Google. I have listened to it and I recommend it highly. I think it's very insightful with lots of good ideas.
Definitely.
Okay, another quote. This returns to a topic that we've already kind of talked about, and it uses a terrible term of ordinary people, smacking of elitism. Ordinary people will find it very difficult. I don't know, Jay, are you ordinary?
I don't know. I don't know if I count in that category.
I don't know. Sometimes, you know, it depends on the time of the day. Sometimes I think I'm ordinary. Ordinary people will find it very difficult to resist this process of AI generating advertising.
Well, it sounds like high-tech elites are not susceptible to clever advertising, whereas I can tell you I don't buy it. I mean, in fact, if anything, they're more susceptible to these things. In fact, it's often elites that are willing to do fashionable things just for the sake of being seen to do it. I wonder, who's he thinking of with these ordinary people? I guess he's thinking of, I don't know, people that just get their coffee at Dairy Queen or something rather than Starbucks.
Yeah, poor ordinary people. Well, let me take a poke from the other side. Certainly, Goebbels, who was a propaganda minister for Nazis, said that you had to hit people with bad propaganda, even false propaganda, again and again and again and again, and ultimately they would believe it. Could this be a precursor of what Harari is talking about?
I think that that's where I would have expected his argument to go, and I think that that is a problem. I think we do need to worry about the use of a sort of absolute political authority to use technology to manipulate us in a much subtler and more sophisticated way. And so, I think if you want to sort of worry about the future, don't spend so much time in 1984. Spend more time in Brave New World. I know when my daughter read both of these books, her junior year in high school, she was more creeped out by Brave New World because she thought, rather than having this kind of Stalinist dictatorship, what we will have is we could have a state that sort of pleases us and fulfills our sort of basest fantasies and gives us drugs that allow us to feel good, and so then controls us in that way. I think that's a genuine worry. Any kind of advance in technology extends our power, and it extends our power for good and for ill. And so I think that's an honest danger. I think we should sort of face that squarely. On the other hand, technology also enhances the power of people. So just as the state might want to do something bad, ordinary people and ordinary citizens also have access to the internet. So it's just like a cop that tries to do something bad now is much more likely to have it videoed and put on YouTube. And so I honestly think technology is almost always a mixed bag. It's something that whether it's good or bad depends very much on what we decide to do with it. And I think that's true in this case as in any.
Excellent. Yeah. I think, again, it's pure elitism. And of course, there's always going to be the pressure of advertising, political campaigns and such. But for some incredible reason, those that are free and live in liberty are able to resist that, I think, a lot easier than most. Okay, I'm going to end with the last quote from the book, and then I'd like you to comment on that, and then maybe your summary of what you think Harari's paper is about. The last quote is, oh gosh, this is hard to read. Currently, humans risk becoming similar to domesticated animals.
I don't know why he's saying this, but I think, again, he's imagining that what we're going to have is these super intelligent AIs. And we're going to be so inferior to them that we're going to have to serve them. Because, of course, domesticated animals, they don't exercise the kind of freedom that we do. They sort of, I've got a domesticated cat here, and he relies on me for absolutely everything. Now, in the sense that we can become more and more dependent upon our technology, okay, yeah, he has sort of a point. But this idea that we're going to become dependent in the sense that we're actually being directed by these super beings, which he believes, he thinks that's what's going to happen. I think that's based entirely upon his sort of fanciful read of where this technology is going. I think if anything, if you think about information technology and focus on that word information, at least the kind of robust information that is involved in a written text or a sculpture or software programming, That's something that's the unique jurisdiction of intelligent agents. And so rather than thinking that an information economy is going to be one that's inhumane or that's going to leave us behind, I think if anything, it's one that's uniquely fit for human beings who are the unique creators and sources of new information. So, and you know, somebody could say, well, that's based upon your kind of anthropological assumptions and what you believe is true about human beings and God. But my argument is, look, let's use these assumptions then to make predictions about the future and see who's more right than wrong when these things actually work their way out.
Excellent. Any final thoughts or summary about Harari's article?
I would say keep a watch on him for listeners that may, you know, really be into this stuff. They might not find the argument all that persuasive, but I think the fact that he went from a fairly unknown character, say even in 2010, an academic in Israel, to an international best-selling author who's, I suspect, will have a PBS series before long.
or maybe Netflix, right?
Yes, or Netflix. Yeah, exactly. Even better, Netflix. That he will, he's a really good representative of this kind of materialist trajectory that is, it's very much a part of the discussion in artificial intelligence. And it's also the trajectory that we're trying to critique and to create an alternative to at the Bradley Center.
Exactly. Excellent. Well, thank you, Jay. By the way, we're talking about a article written by Yuval Noah Harari, which is published in The Atlantic. We'll provide a link to that. Jay, could you say something about The Atlantic? I looked at some of their articles, and they seem to be politically very liberal.
Yeah, they're mostly politically to the left, but it's not a left-wing publication like The Nation or The Guardian. They have known and been around for decades, but they're known for publishing these long thought essays like this. And so actually, in my book, The Human Advantage, I often quote from The Atlantic because in some ways, they are articles in The Atlantic more often than not are a perfect distillation of the kind of elite consensus, conventional wisdom on a particular topic. And certainly this piece by Harari is an example of that.
Exactly. Well, Jay Richards, thank you very much. Our guest has been Jay Richards. He's has a professor position in the School of Business and Economics at the Catholic University of America, and is also the executive editor of The Stream, which is at thestream.org. So if you want to follow up on Jay and some of the things that he's doing, also go to Amazon, look at his books, especially his most recent book, which I have listened to. And let's see if I have the name of that, The Human Advantage, The Future of American Work in an Age of Smart Machines. Jay, thank you again.
Great to be with you.
Okay, so for Mind Matters, until next time, be of good cheer.
This has been Mind Matters with your host, Robert J. Marks. Explore more at mindmatters.ai. That's mindmatters.ai. Mind Matters is directed and edited by Austin Egbert. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the speakers. Mind Matters is produced and copyrighted by the Walter Bradley Center for Natural and Artificial Intelligence at Discovery Institute.